So these are some quick comments, but then mostly I'm going to read some passages from Malcolm X's speech to Mississippi youth and Stokely Carmichael's talk to students, to college students at Morgan State. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the guys and then the overall set of points that they make, which I think are very simple and very direct, but very powerful. And then I'm just going to read a whole bunch of passages from them because these are some of my favorite speakers in the world. I love the way that they use language. I love how pushy they are. Maybe it's kind of interesting that Malcolm X educated himself partially in prison, whereas Stokely Carmichael, he was a philosophy major. And yet they have largely the same attitude. So I just want to read their own words for you because I think I couldn't do any better. And I don't think they need tons of interpretation. But I will say, I imagine most of you know who Malcolm X is. Everybody's heard of Malcolm X, right? Let's see. I guess the main thing that I would point out about Malcolm X is that everybody thinks of him in terms of violence and black power. And as Stokely Carmichael points out, there's an unfortunate tendency to identify the black power movement with violence. As both of them say, they're not particularly pro-violence. They just refuse to submit to the idea that they have to be nonviolent, and that's a radically different thing. What they're actually interested in is community strength, self-determination, the power of local communities to push back against a large-scale structure which objectively exploits them. The other thing that the two of them have in common is that maybe not right away at the beginning of their prominent careers, and they both become kind of prominent figures at a relatively young age, especially Carmichael. Eventually, they come to the position that the struggle of black people in the United States, and again, this is one of those situations where I think you can ask, how far do you want to extend this analysis? It is not necessarily the case that it's only black folks who are in conditions like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael describe, but they eventually come to the position that black folks in the United States have natural allies globally, and that the struggle of this particular group, and you might ask, what about the struggle of other oppressed groups in the United States? And if you really wanted to push it pretty far, even the working class is an exploited group, that these groups have natural allies across the globe. So the term in the specific case of the Black Power Movement is Pan-Africanism. The realization that these guys make that the struggle of African people against colonization by Europe is a part of the same large global struggle of black folks against the white power structure that surrounds them. They both emerge from the same history. They both continue the same sets of relationships. And therefore, there is a natural affinity between colonized people in the United States, which is how Carmichael would define the situation of black people here, colonized people in the United States and colonized people more broadly. Okay, so that's Malcolm X. Stokely Carmichael, slightly less known, I suppose, although pretty darn well known, actually. He was, first of all, a student organizer in SNCC, the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but very importantly, that's a group that, very importantly for understanding where he's coming from and what he has to say, that's a group that eventually changed its name from Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to Student National Coordinating Committee because they decided, along with Malcolm X at some point, that they would refuse to take a principled stand against the use of any kind of force because they thought that this was unnecessarily limiting the struggle, and they thought that it was unreasonable and unacceptable to condemn, this is how Stokely puts it in this text, to condemn black kids who throw bottles at cops or whatever. They're angry and they have reasons to be angry, and he refused to condemn them for this. Okay, so these guys, oh, and then he eventually also becomes a, you know, a Pan-Africanist like Malcolm X. He spends a lot more time that way, though. He changes his name in honor of liberation leaders in Africa. He changes his name to Kwame Ture, and he eventually moves to Africa and spends the rest of his life there. But this is him talking at a younger age. Now, let me say, like, what I think are the basic questions that are raised by each of these guys, and I really think that these are probably the questions we ought to talk about in class. There aren't that many questions, but they're really important ones. They're really pushy ones. The first question that comes from the Malcolm X speech, and by the way, he, you know, it's introduced there, but he's talking to Mississippi youth, right? Teenagers who SNCC had brought to visit Malcolm X in New York City. So he's talking to teenage youth in super impacted community, really hard hit with racist violence, and in the middle of the struggle for civil rights. What's the first question that he thinks we ought to ask? He thinks you ought to ask. You ought to really try to figure out who are really your friends and who are really your enemies. Now, this is a much more practical question than a lot of the philosophical ones that we've asked in this class, but it's a pretty good philosophical, practical question. It doesn't seem like you would be capable of operating in social space in determining, you know, what are the appropriate kinds of action with the people, with respect to the people around you, if you haven't answered the question, who's with me and who's against me? Who are my people? And if you're just going to buy that everybody's your people and everybody's your friend, well, you're not really paying attention. And you can have what you might consider to be a happier worldview by that means, but you'll also be objectively in a worse situation in terms of how your life is going to turn out and whether your actions are rational or not. So who are your friends and who are your enemies? And I think we can ask this question both locally, in LA, at this school, in this room, who are your friends and who are your enemies? It's not that everybody has to be one or the other, but both exist. Who are your friends and who are your enemies? And then also worldwide, who are your friends and who are your enemies? And the thing I'm pointing at here is both Malcolm and Stokely believe that oppressed peoples worldwide share a basic condition. They are all colonized. They all have been colonized. The effects of colonization are visible in all kinds of communities. Those communities share a condition. They also share an interest to become uncolonized. They also share an enemy, namely the colonizer, right? So locally, a practically minded, a practical, intelligent person has to identify who their friends are and who their enemies are, and the same thing globally. And notice that this also means that you got to be able to understand something about the globe. You should be able to find where countries are on the map. You should be able to understand what's going on in terms of global political and military struggle. If you can't, you don't know who your friends are on a large scale, and you can't reach out to them, and you can't help them, and they can't help you, and therefore both you and they will be weakened. If you want to really be able to advance yourself in the world, not in the way that you're told you're supposed to advance yourself, but in a way that really benefits you, then you have to study this world. Okay, second question. What about nonviolence? Both of these guys refuse to accept the idea that all struggle has to be nonviolent. Ta-Nehisi Coates points this out, and one of you brought this up last week as one of your favorite questions. The question, a specific question that he asked was, how come in his high school largely for black people, they were shown video of people with Martin Luther King getting attacked by dogs and so on and not fighting back? How come this population of kids young adults was offered the model of nonviolent submission as the thing that they ought to imitate, the model of a good person, of a good black person. How come that model is distributed? Well, if you want to be practical about it, it's distributed because somebody or other wants oppressed people to act like that. It's a whole lot more useful from the perspective of those who are not oppressed or even those who are doing the oppressing to have an oppressed population that submits and that even if it complains nonviolently. So Malcolm and Stokely have the same response to this, which is, nonviolence is nice. And the first place that we need nonviolence is in our own communities. Notice this requires understanding who are your friends, who are your people, and who are not. Nonviolence in those communities. You got to build love, got to build trust, got to build solidarity, got to do things as a community, got to commit to one another. Nonviolence on that front. But wherever that community is attacked, sure, violence. Somebody attacks your kid, you're going to hit him with a bat if you've got a bat. I will. Right? Because I love my kid and I'm not going to let that happen. Somebody attacks me, I'm going to punch back. If a community is attacked, that community ought to defend itself too. This is the position. And this is what gets defined as militancy and unacceptable violent attitudes from outside the community. So who's defining for you? Is it the interests that are opposed to you? Who are telling you how you ought to act and what is acceptable and what is a good person? And if you imitate the model that is given you by people who are objectively your enemies, who's going to benefit from that? Okay, then over to Stokely. Stokely's one of his main positions here is that, you know, the first need of a free people is to define their own terms. You need to be defining your own terms. Specifically, you need to ask and answer the questions, what are you going to identify as good behavior? What models do you hold up? Do you accept the model about success, money-making, and integration would have been the term in the 60s, the idea that even if you're from a poorer community or a less privileged community, you can just do what they tell you, brush your teeth, say yes, sir, to the boss, do whatever advertising, marketing, analysis, sales, whatever the boss tells you to do, you just do it. You do it good. And then you'll be good. This is the lesson that you are given from above. You know, these models of success that are all over the campus, they're like that. You too can be one of the people who works for the companies. You too, therefore, will be good. You too will succeed. But who's defining that model for you? It's not you. It's coming from outside. It's being offered to you for you to imitate. But what if you were to identify your own models? What if you were to define your own terms? So what, from your real perspective, knowing where you actually stand, knowing who your actual friends and enemies are, what should you really define as good behavior? And clearly, I can't tell you that, but you should think about it. What are you going to define as beauty? Is it going to be the super skinny people, the super skinny white guys and white girls that you're held up, that are held up to you as what goodness looks like, or the lighter people as the prettier people? Is that going to be beauty? Because if you don't think about it, it will be, and you're going to feel bad all day long for not matching those standards. Or are you going to take control of the definitions and define for yourself what your values are? Define for yourself what beauty is. Define for yourself what culture is. And then, of course, there is a last question which we already touched on, but which both of these guys raise, particularly Stokely, and that is the question, again, that Kayser asked, and that was, what are we going to define as civilization? Are we going to accept that whatever surrounds us really is the peak of humanity, the best it's ever been? Or are we going to assert ourselves, use our own minds, and try to understand what we would consider to be civilized in the strongest sense? Okay, so that's my kind of overview of the content here. But now I'm going to take, I don't know how long, because I got all kinds of passages from Malcolm X and from Stokely Carmichael that I just want to read because they're so good. So here's Malcolm X, 1964. One of the first things I think young people, especially nowadays, should learn is how to see for yourself and listen for yourself and think for yourself. Then you can come to an intelligent decision for yourself. If you form the habit of going by what you hear others say about someone or going by what others think about someone, instead of searching that thing out for yourself and seeing for yourself, you will be walking west when you think you're going east. And you will be walking east when you think you're going west. This generation, especially of our people, has a burden, more so than any other time in history. The most important thing that we can learn today is think for ourselves. It is good to keep wide open ears and listen to what everybody else has to say. But when you come to make a decision, you have to weigh all of what you've heard on its own and place it where it belongs, and come to a decision for yourself. You'll never regret it. But if you form the habit of taking what someone else says about a thing without checking it out for yourself, you'll find that other people will have you hating your friends and loving your enemies. This is one of the things that our people are beginning to learn today, that it is very important to think out a situation for yourself. If you don't do it, you'll always be maneuvered into a situation where you are never fighting your actual enemies, where you will find yourself fighting your own self. Skip ahead a bit. This is the nonviolence one. I myself would go for nonviolence if it was consistent, if everybody was going to be nonviolent all the time. I'd say, okay, let's get with it. We'll all be nonviolent. But I don't go along with any kind of nonviolence unless everybody's going to be nonviolent. If they make the Ku Klux Klan nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. If they make the White Citizens Council nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. But as long as you've got somebody else not being nonviolent, I don't want anybody coming to me talking about any nonviolent talk. I don't think it is fair to tell our people to be nonviolent unless someone is out there making the Klan and the Citizens Council and these other groups also be nonviolent. All right, now page 140. He's been giving this history about how the condition of black folks changed a little bit around World War II because their labor was needed and therefore they were able to get better positions. But he just wants to point out that this is not due to the morality on the part of the white civilization. They weren't drafting him when the war first started. This is what they thought of you and me in those days. For one thing, they didn't trust us. They feared that if they put us in the army and trained us in how to use rifles and other things, we might shoot at some targets that they hadn't picked out. And we would have. Any thinking man knows what target to shoot at. If a man has to have someone else to choose his target, then he isn't thinking for himself. They're doing the thinking for him. Page 142. Never, at any time in the history of our people in this country, have we made advances or progress in any way based upon the internal goodwill of this country. We have made advancement in this country only when this country was under pressure from forces above and beyond its control. The internal moral consciousness of this country is bankrupt. It hasn't existed since they first brought us over here and made slaves out of us. They make it appear that they have our good interests at heart. But when you study it, every time, no matter how many steps they take us forward, it's like we're standing on a treadmill. The treadmill is moving backwards faster than we're able to go forward in this direction. We're not even standing still. We're going backwards. In studying the process of this so-called progress during the past 20 years, we of the Organization of Afro-American Unity realized that the only time the black man in this country is given any kind of recognition or even listened to is when America is afraid of outside pressure or when she's afraid of her image abroad. So we saw that it was necessary to expand the problem and the struggle of the black man in this country until it went above and beyond the jurisdiction of the United States. You got to think about who are your friends and who are your enemies on a broader scale. All right, and then 145. So don't you run around here trying to make friends with somebody who's depriving you of your rights. They're not your friends. No, they're your enemies. Treat them like that and fight them, and you'll get your freedom. And after you get your freedom, your enemy will respect you and will respect you. And I say that with no hate. I don't have hate in me. I have no hate at all. I don't have any hate. I've got some sense. I'm not going to let somebody who hates me tell me to love him. All right, now over to Stokely Carmichael. Tons of beautiful stuff in here, too. So let's see. I'll start with the quotation he gives from Frederick Douglass. "Those who profess to favor freedom, yet deprecate agitation, are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Power concedes nothing without demands. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what any people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they have resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they suppress." All right, shorter quotations in some of these cases from Carmichael. Well, just this first one, I guess. Page 64. "Perhaps that is the greatest problem you, as black students, face. You are never asked to create, only to imitate." And again, you know, the reason to read this is that I think that these considerations extend probably beyond black folks. Then we come to the question of definitions. It is very, very important because people who can define are the masters. Understand that. Page 65. "The first need of a free people is to be able to define their own terms and have those terms recognized by their oppressors. It is also the first need that all oppressors must suppress." A little bit further down. This is about defining terms, right? And watching out for how terms are defined. We all watch cowboy movies all the time. You know, there would be a fight and there would be Indians and they would be coming from down from the hills, and Chief Crazy Horse would have a million Indians and they would be yelling, "Wah, wah, wah," and they would be killing the good white women. And at last, here comes the cavalry. They would come riding in and they would get out their guns and shoot up everybody. "Men, forward march, forward, shoot. Look out, that one on the right, boom, we've got him, he's dead." They would come back and they would say, "We had a victory today. We killed the Indians." The next time, the Indians would win. They would beat the hell out of the cavalry, and the white man would come back and say, "Those dirty Indians, they massacred us." See what they were doing? They were putting connotations in our minds. A massacre is not as good as a victory, because in a victory, you shoot people and you kill them in an honorable way. But in a massacre, you kill with a knife, and everybody knows that's foul. But the Indians had victories too. That we must begin to recognize. That's very important. And by the way, we talked about this in class last time. It is possible to step back and recognize that the Indians had victories too. We are given one perspective where the colonial culture is taken as the normative one. And the Indians are bad guys and backwards and savage and barbarians, and they only massacre people, and the cavalry are the good guys and all that. That's true. That's our situation, and that's what we got to work our way out of. But we can do that. We can do it by trying to understand the perspective of Native American people. We can read their accounts, various things like this. Okay, just a little bit further down. "The power to define is the most important power that we have. It is he who is master who can define." That was cleared in the McCarthy period. If McCarthy said you were a communist, you had to get up and say, "No, I am not a communist." Who the hell is McCarthy? I mean, who is he? He had the power to define. It is the same thing. "My fellow Americans, the communists, the slant-eyed Viet Cong are our enemy. You must go kill them." You don't have the right to define whether or not that cat is your enemy. The master has defined it for you. And when he says jump, you say, how high, boss? We must begin to define our own terms and certainly our own concept of ourselves and let those who are not capable of following us fall by the wayside. You must begin to understand the nature of this country called America, which exploits all other non-white countries. You know what they are talking about. You see, that's the thing with definitions. You know we are fighting for freedom, democracy, for peace. Nobody questions it. Yes, we are going to kill for freedom, democracy, and peace. These little Chinese, Vietnamese, yellow people haven't got sense enough to know they want their democracy, but we are going to fight for them. We'll give it to them because Santa Claus is still alive. Here's a tiny little passing thing, a couple sentences down. I think the trouble with our black students is that they just don't read enough. Expand that one. I think the problem with our students is that they just don't read enough. Nobody's got a taste for reading. Why not? Because you don't have your own intellectual project. You don't have your own questions. But you ought to have your own questions. If you understand your own situation, every situation involves important questions. Every community has questions. Okay, page 68. If you understand anything about this country, you know that 75% of the budget is spent on war materials. That means that for this country to survive, it must always be at war. You will not get a victory for this country if you win in Vietnam. That's no victory. The country must keep fighting. You do not invent things that have no use. You invent them so that they can have a use. And every time you invent a better bomb, you must drop it. So you invent another bomb. That is why this country keeps going at the breakneck speed it is going in terms of its military might. We are told that it is civilized. Another word to define. Page 69. But the white people brought their concepts. When they left, they had the land, and we had their religion. And that was civilization for them. Indeed, what is civilization? To be able to drop bombs on Hiroshima? To be able to drop bombs on Hanoi? Is that civilization? Do we want to be civilized too? This country has said that civilization is at stake and there is no other solution but war. So what they do is train us in ROTC. You dig it? All they do in ROTC is teach you how to kill. You may try to justify it all you want, but your job is to kill. The job of the army is to kill. ROTC doesn't teach you how to become anything. If you want me to be taught something, build a school in my neighborhood and let me go there. Don't tell me about going to Vietnam to learn anything. I have to be appalled at the president of the university who stands up and says that black power is about violence, while at this very campus he encourages institutionalized violence, compulsory ROTC, and does not speak about that. Who does he think he is kidding? There is nothing wrong with violence. It is just who is able to control it. That's what counts. Everybody knows that. You have institutionalized violence on your campus. You have to dress up in a monkey suit and train how to kill once a week. And what is your response to that as black students coming to a university where they are supposed to teach you civilization? Is that civilization too? That one must kill? Is that what you are imitating? Is it for you not to reason why at a university, but to do and die? Do you not have the guts to say, hell no? Do you not have the guts to say, I will not allow anyone to make me a hired killer? When I decide to kill, since it is the greatest crime that man can commit, I alone will make that decision, and I will decide whom to kill. Bottom of page 70. The reason they say that we preach violence isn't because we preach violence, but because we refuse to condemn black people who throw rocks and bottles at policemen. That is why. And I say that this is the only reason why. Page 71. Big ol' economic point he makes here, I think. Still valid as far as I'm concerned. What it points out is the problem between property rights and human rights in this country, a problem the country is not capable of facing up to. Let one black boy throw one rock at some filthy grocery store and the whole damn National Guard comes into our ghetto. property rights means more than human rights, and we in the ghetto do not own the property. If we get robbed, you can call the policeman till you turn white. He ain't coming. You know it as well as I do. But just hit a grocery store, just throw a Molotov cocktail through a window, and see how quick they come in. They deplore violence. It's all right with them when we cut each other in the street on Friday and Saturday nights. We need nonviolence in the black community. That's where we need it. We have to learn to love and respect ourselves. That's where it should begin. That is where it must begin. Because if we don't love us, ain't nobody going to love us. The people who have power in our ghettos are the property owners, and when their stores are touched, they call the National Guard. Page 72. You are college students. You should think. Page 74. Do you question what they tell you at school? Or do you only accept, carry it back, get over, go out to further stymie black people in the ghetto? I blame you for the rebellions across the country this summer. And I will blame you again when they increase this summer. It is your obligation to be back in the ghetto helping out black people who are looking, who are acting, begging, and thinking a way to solve their problems. And you are running out of the ghetto as fast as your sports cars and Mustangs can carry you. What is your responsibility, black students of Morgan? Do you know about Du Bois? Have you read Douglass? Do you know Richard Wright? Can you quote J.A. Rogers? Do you know Claude McKay? Can you understand? Can you understand Leroy Jones? There is a young man with me now. His name is Eldridge Cleaver. He just spent 8 years in jail. He is writing some of the most profound writing that has come out in the country from black men. Do you know him? Have you read his stuff? Why haven't you read his stuff? Is it because you are too busy trying to find out where the Kappas are partying Friday night? Why is it that you haven't read his stuff? Is it that you are spit-shining your shoes so that you can become a lieutenant colonel to go to Vietnam when you graduate? Why is it that you haven't read his stuff? Is it that you don't want to read anything about being black because you too are ashamed of it and running from it? Page 75. You had better recognize that individualism is a luxury that black students can no longer afford. You had better begin to see yourself as a people and as a group, and therefore, you need to help to advance that group. And then the very end here. The last statement that I want to leave you with is by John Donne. He said, "The death of any man diminishes me because I am involved in mankind." This generation is not involved in mankind. When we began to crawl, they sent 6 million people to an oven, and we blinked our eyes. When we walked, they sent our uncles to Korea, and we grew up in a Cold War. We, this generation, must save the world. We must become involved in mankind. We must not allow them the chance to kill everything and anything that gets in their way. We must not become part of the machine. I want to read my favorite quotation to conclude. If I am not for myself, who will be? If I am for myself alone, who am I? If not now, when? And if not you, who?